Recording has started. You can begin with your intros.
This is Jean Munson. I am 32 years old. Today is Saturday, September 19, 2020. Currently recording from Las Vegas, Nevada, and I am the colleague of my partner here.
Hi, I'm Jenny Stiles. I'm 33 years old. Today is Saturday, September 19, 2020. I'm in Las Vegas, Nevada, and I am with my colleague, Jean Munson.
I am really happy to be up on a Saturday morning because I love you, even if this is unusual. I've been coffee free, so I'm like, I must really love Jenny to be here. So I just wanted to start the, you know, in this space telling you how much I love you. And and so, you know, we are kind of unlikely friends in a way.
Yeah. We met in an odd way, dare I say?
Yes, an odd way, which sometimes I characterize like being part of like the X-Men, right? Because we're chosen and we're generationally placed. So I'll give you the honor of telling us how we know each other.
We know each other because we were both part of New Leadership Nevada. It's a women's leadership conference. Held in Nevada, always held at UNLV, but includes women from all over the state.
Yes.
Where we live together in the dorms, and we have leaders called FERS who help us guide us through our journey through leadership and empowerment, dare I say. Right. And we get panels from all kinds of women from different sectors of the world and in different types of businesses and things like that. And we talk about, you know, things like mentorship, being able to find your way through school, especially like if you're a minority, because it can be hard to get an education and actually get into a leadership role, and just to kind of, it's very much about togetherness too, which I think fights a lot of the stereotypes that are put on women, that we're all like each other out of the way. And like in my year of new leadership, we were all like very like, we were so tight, we were crying all the time. Our last day we were all sobbing hysterically. It was ridiculous. We're all like, we don't want to leave each other. And it was a great experience. And we all just, I think we all got a lot from it, but we all just like at night in the dorm, it was like sleepaway camp. It really was for us, because we were in pajamas in the lounge of the dorm, like up until like ridiculous hours. Cause we got up at ridiculous hours. We were up until like midnight, maybe one. And then we would wake up at like 5 a.m. or earlier. And it was just like, why did we do that? But we did it all again. I wouldn't change a thing. The lack of sleep was worth it.
It was before this, before self-care was trending like about 3 years ago. So that's how leaders were. So, get up really early, stay up really late and whatnot. What year were you again, Jenny?
Oh, geez. Don't ask me.
Were you 2011 or 2012?
I think I was 2012. Yeah, I was 2012. Yeah.
So just a fun fact about 2012. Well, two fun facts about 2012. 2012 was the last year before we had no money to run that program.
So, really?
We were going to be the last class. And so it's kind of miraculous.
Weren't we like year 10 or something?
Yeah. So we were out of money.
happens in for great programs like that.
Yeah. And nonprofits, right?
Completely.
You know, and a lot of nonprofits don't know how to sustain those like data about how to, you know, keep it going and whatnot, or grants.
Fundraising and getting grants and things like that. That is an entire like education all its own. I have done nonprofit now since I was 13 in different ways, and for the last like 10 years mostly fundraising. You have to be really creative, and you have to be willing to socialize a lot. It's a lot about talking, it's a lot about talking, it's a lot about like actually like sitting down with people and like making relationship.
And Jenny, the other fun fact is that you were our only openly disabled attendee. Can you tell us
prior
to that experience at New Leadership, and then how it was experiencing New Leadership in both in that role?
Well, at the time, let's start off. I've been disabled since birth. I have chronic illnesses. I was born with multiple birth defects. We have no reasoning really for it. There's theories, but you know. So I was born with multiple birth defects and all those things. And I have been working through education with those disabilities in one way or another with difficulties, but I really love education. I really love learning. So I just go through it. And I found out about leadership because I was a volunteer and a chair for the Women's Center's Take Back the Night event. I was a co-chair for that. And I was very much in that mindset of like helping women that have gone through interpersonal violence, because I know so many women who have been through it. And I was super passionate about it at the time. And it was brought up to me like, hey, there's this thing. And I thought I missed the deadline because I was reading it off the school newsletter, the UNLV newsletter. And I'm like, oh, I missed the deadline. Oh, darn. And then like, I was emailing Christina Hernandez, who used to run the Women's Center. And she goes, you know, you can still do it. They're extending applications. And I'm like, what? She's like, get it in as soon as possible. And then I was also told that this was quite extraordinary too. I got 4 reference letters because I was so nervous.
You actually did, because I was just sifting through the, because I have to scan all of them to preserve them. Yeah, you did get 4 letters.
Part of it was because one of them I wasn't sure was going to make it. So I decided to like just double down and make sure like they just got through in time. Because I know one person I asked, like, they definitely wanted to do it, but they're like, I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to get it in time. So I just, like, I doubled down and was like, just go, just as many as I can get.
Right.
I'm slightly ambitious. And so I got into it a week before New Leadership.
Wow.
I was told that I was going into kidney failure because I've had a kidney transplant 14 years prior to that, and I was in kidney failure and the transplant failed, and I was very nervous about it all. And I was already nervous beforehand. The idea of disability and leadership sharing the same sphere is very unheard of and is always kind of questioned. And also the fact of, as a disabled person, I have lived with my parents my entire life just because I have medical needs in which someone should be there around me most of the time, just in case there are emergencies. And I was so nervous because I had never like lived away or like been
right.
There's no one with any knowledge of my medical conditions. And it is, you live in the dorms for a week. At least you did in 2012. Not right now in COVID time.
No.
COVID, no. And I remember my fiance was very like pushing me to do it. He's like, this is perfect for you. Just go do it. You'll be fine. And luckily I have a fiance who is just incredibly like supportive in that way. And that is another thing I found about like a lot of the women there that are younger than me. I'm 33. I'm not the average college age. A lot of them, like when it came to New Leadership, apparently a lot of their male partners, the ones that had male partners, were very like, why are you doing this? Why do you even need to do
right.
this? Are you becoming some weird feminist? Like
feminist camp.
Just yeah. Exactly. Feminist camp. My fiance already knows I'm one of those weird feminists. he's like, yeah, so. But he's like, yeah, no, go do it. You need to do this. I think you'll get a lot from it. And I did. But yes, as far as I knew, as far as I'm aware, and I think we've checked this. And you speak to a lot of the women in New Leadership.
Yeah, current, yes, yeah.
Currently and from the past. And I am the first openly disabled person to be at New Leadership. I disclosed my disability and my chronic illness. I do not have a problem doing that. I am usually very open about it because I feel as an advocate that you need to be open about that if you're comfortable with it, which I very much am, because if we don't see people with disability, even just within our own community, not even in media, which that is a huge problem. Mm-hmm. But if you don't know the person sitting next to you doing the same things you're doing as disabled, you don't build that idea that disabled people can do the exact same thing you can do, if not just in a different mode. So I was open about it. I think everybody knew. At the time, I wasn't using mobility aids. I use a mobility aid now to get around. But yeah, everyone knew. My legs were swelling because that's part of kidney failure. You can't get rid of fluid as easily. That's what your kidneys do. And my legs were just like huge. They were tree trunks on some days, and I was just getting through it. But I loved what I was doing. So, you know, if you love what you're doing, you can usually find ways to get through things if it's not actually detrimental to you in a certain way. It was just uncomfortable, but it was very cool being and having that scope. And I remember going through new leadership and having to poke at people and go, excuse me, when you mentioned minorities or when you mentioned different demographics, you didn't mention disability. And the most jarring moment was Christina Hernandez was one of the people that did, it wasn't a panel, but she did an exercise with us. It's an exercise about privilege where we're out in a field and we take a step forward or a step back, depending on the statement and if we had privilege in that area or we didn't have privilege in that area.
Right.
And I had to go up to her afterwards and go, excuse me, Christina, I know you didn't mean to do this because I've known Christina for years and I know her partner and I've known Sabrina for years and I love them both so much. And I went, I know you don't mean to do this because also Sabrina has a disabled brother that I believe has since passed away. I'm like, I know you didn't mean to do this, but you didn't mention disability as part of the
prompt.
And I'm like, maybe you could change that next time or start adding that. And she looked at me and she goes, I didn't even realize I wasn't mentioning it. It didn't even dawn on me. And I'm like, it's okay. I know it didn't come from a bad place. It was just a place of, it's again, you don't see it. So why are you even going to mention it? Out of sight, out of mind. So I told her, I'm just like, that's why I'm mentioning it. I'm like, I'm not mad. I'm not angry. I'm not even upset. I'm just saying, next time, could you? And she goes, of course. It's been added every time afterwards. And I'm like, thank you.
Yes, it has. Yeah. Wow. It's really great to know where that has rooted itself in because I'm currently running the program. And so that's a moment of leadership, right? It's not always standing behind a podium or whatnot, right? It's having that kind of discourse and assessing intention versus interaction. Can you expand a little bit more about what are some simple steps that people who may be future applicants of new leadership or who want to get into these kinds of programs all over the country, what kind of advocacy steps or mindset they need to set themselves up for to kind of be where you are, Jenny?
I would say just honestly, just talking, speaking when it comes to disability, ask about accessibility, whether you know the person is disabled or not. Because sometimes, I mean, we've all met people who just don't like going upstairs or find it hard to going upstairs. They wouldn't consider themselves sick or disabled. They just may have bad knees, and that doesn't make you sick or disabled. That just means that the body wears down. I'm in my 30s, and my knees were never a problem, but they're a problem now, okay? It's sometimes asking, can we do something to make this easier for you, to make this more accessible for you, to make this to make this day go easier for you. Sometimes it's not about what you can and cannot do. Sometimes it's just making the day just go a little bit easier. And that's what it is. We in this day of technology, so much technology was built to make things more convenient and easier and quicker. And that's what accessibility is. It is convenience for someone who absolutely needs it to do something. We have phones that we talk to now instead of typing an email out or something. That is actually an accessibility device. That's accessibility software. Wow. It was built for accessibility and disability before it was created, just so that you can Google search something without having to type something. Those things, even being able to speak and things come up on your Word document, that is accessibility. The things we don't know, many things like that, lots of electronics, are built from accessibility standpoints. They're not built from, oh, let's make it easier for everybody else. It came from a person going, I actually can't do this. Like, this is not something I can actively do. How do we change that? You know, innovation comes from necessity. And, you know, a lot of things that a lot of able-bodied people don't know come from a person with a disability needing to be able to do something, and some lovely engineer or scientist just came up with it. So ask about, what do you need? Ask about, am I mentioning you? Am I adding you to the conversation? It's the same as any minority. It's the same as anything that we may not see. And as a point of leadership, it is literally just speaking up. I think leadership at the most part is just speaking up. The amount of times I've spoken up and just people have been like, oh, I didn't know that. It is education. I believe the most important part of nonprofit of anything is awareness, because you do not, you can't fix something that you don't know about.
Right. I mean,
just recently, I was talking to, I talked about four people. It was weird. It was a weird week for me. It was brought up to me that my stepfather was like, I was taught to not say disability in, in my training. I'm like, why? And he's like, oh, we were told to say alternatively abled. I'm like, that's a problem. That's not something a disabled person came up with. That was something that an able-bodied person came up with so that they could avoid saying the word disabled, because we think the word disabled is a dirty word, and it's not. I know the majority of the community does not mind the word disabled. We don't like the word alternatively abled because, one, it makes us sound like superheroes. I did not get superpowers from my disability. Sorry to say. I'd love to be Wonder Woman. My favorite superhero is Ms. Marvel. I'd love to embiggen. I can't. But it also, I was saying, like, because people are like, why is this wrong? And I'm like, if you are a person of color, wouldn't you like, would you like to be called alternatively colored or alternatively skinned? No, no one wants to be called the alternative. No one wants to be the alternative of anything. You are a human being. You're not alternative. You are a person that might be slightly deviated from what we accept as the norm, but that does not make you other. That just makes you unique. That means that we are not all a mold. We're not all clones. And that is perfectly fine. So that's what my week has been, like talking about disability language, which I love words. I'm a writer. One of my favorite things is talking about words. So I have no problem with it.
Yeah, to me, you know, with everything that you said, you definitely call people in, you know, versus calling out. And I think that takes a lot of compassion to see that, okay, that they can't see it within their own privilege, you know, whether they are the most activist like Christina or myself. And so, I thank you for that. I just want to say thank you, because that really is like, it forces me to also look at things in an ironic way, or what the shoe looks like on the other foot and whatnot. So
we all have to look at our privilege and look what our privilege has blinded us to, not even just given us that other people haven't had as easily, but like just what we haven't seen. Luckily, my mother taught me that most people aren't coming from a malicious point. They are coming from a point of just ignorance. When that ignorance comes from a want, I want to be ignorant, I don't want to know this, that's a problem, that's malicious.
Yeah, so okay.
I've literally never been told, I have never come in contact with that. That's an okay ignorance. That can be fixed easily. That can be fixed with questions. That can be fixed with a great conversation. And the thing is, a lot of those conversations lead to friendship or better relationships, I find. And it's just, it's me recognizing that my privilege has blinded me, because I am a white woman. There are plenty of things I have not seen and I have not been through. Please educate me. You are an able-bodied person. Let me educate you. Let's have a good conversation. Let's see where we match up to. Let's see where both of our differences have matched up and where we can see each other at the same level. So because having being unprivileged with some things allows you to see the on the same level with other people that have also not had privileges in certain areas, even if they're different. And I think that's my favorite part of being disabled, is that I can join a larger community and I can see other people and be like, okay, you're not disabled, but we are all here trying to just level the playing field and trying to like also just, you know, accept and encourage each other's differences. And to me, my disability has allowed me to do that in wonderful ways. So I've never seen my disability as a negative. I think it allows me to open the conversation up even further. And as someone who is a writer and a journalist, and I love interviewing people and getting to know them, I love opening a space for somebody to like be there and just like speak their truth. And that's where my life as a disabled person has allowed me to like have that warmth. So I mean, I love having those conversations, and I love like seeing that person being like, oh, I totally get that. I'm like, it wasn't that hard to get either, because we're all human. And we all have those moments of like, someone doesn't see me. So it's that connection.
So it's been 8 years since 2012, and we are now in 2020. So can you tell us, you know, me, about how your life has been since these 8 years? And then let's jump into time here in 2020.
So I've been through 5.5 years of dialysis, which I like to call purgatory. I had to go all out of school. I couldn't work. I was just going through that journey. I got a transplant from a police officer in California, a living donor who is just a marvelous human being who tells the best dad jokes. So hopefully I can use that ability with his kidney. I have gone back to school. I have my journalism major, which I love. I'm a junior now in school, and I am just adoring what I'm doing. I am working as a program assistant at UNLV Volunteers, which creates volunteer events, especially when there isn't COVID. We're creating in-person volunteer events for health and wellness, environmental, food and housing insecurity, civic engagement. And it's a dream job. I love it. I do the marketing for them right now, and I help come up with events, and we spotlight different organizations and different ways to volunteer. And I just adore it. I love the nonprofit sector. If for some reason I can't get a job in journalism right away, I'm perfectly happy sitting in my nonprofit sector, just, you know, doing the good work. I think both are very available to help people and do a lot of good work. So I think I personally see them very similarly. So I love both, but I love what I'm doing right now.
Jenny, you are such a giver, right? So like I can feel the excitement from you talking about the work that you do, and to know that, because I have been part of indirectly fundraisers to get you these transplants.
Yes.
Friends,
thank you so much.
Las Vegas is actually a small town. Yeah, it's a really small town. And so, yeah, your name would surface. And I even like, you know, at the start of Facebook, I was like, Jenny Stiles, that sounds familiar, right? And I knew then we were part of both new leadership. So the years leading up to where you are now, you have fought and lived each of those years. And you have done also like Facebook updates to kind of normalize and create visibility around the dialysis part. Yes. And, you know, and you went through some really like mental hoops to keep sustaining through that. Can you explain more on that?
Dialysis is something we don't see a lot of. It is life on a machine. If you're a Harry Potter fan, I like to explain it as living a half-life, like how Voldemort is told to do after he drinks the blood of a unicorn. You live a half-life. That is what living on dialysis is. It is living on a machine. You have to, the machine essentially, you get your blood, sorry for anyone out there, it's squeamish, takes your blood out of your body through tubes that are in your arm or chest, and it circulates it to get fluid out, because your kidneys are actually what makes your urine and allows you to pee. Your bladder actually just is a reservoir for it. And then it filters, because your kidney actually filters all of the toxins out of your body. We all think the liver does that. The liver only does some of that. The kidney actually does most of that, and it regulates the potassium and sodium and the phosphorus in your body. So it's a very important organ, even if we think it's not. It is essential. And it's actually your kidney that actually controls your blood pressure. It's not your heart. So it's very important. And I was born with kidney disease. And I had had a transplant prior when I was 12 years old. It lasted 14 years, thankfully. And I was on dialysis for 5.5 years, which is not abnormal. The wait time right now is roughly, at least my transplant was in California. It goes by state relatively, or region. Mm-hmm. And my wait time was 11 to 12 years on dialysis. If I had to go off the list, that's why I'm sure you saw I was campaigning to find a living donor.
Yeah.
I had 25 people call in to be tested. Either they couldn't because they had a chronic illness, or they decided to back out once they found out that they were a match.
Wow.
Yeah. Everyone thinks matching is the hard part. Nowadays, it really isn't, because they have a lot of different therapies they can use to give someone who isn't the right blood type to actually give that kidney to the other person. There's plenty of things you can do. Matching is actually the least of the problem nowadays. It is that there's like a lack of kidney donors out there. We need more living kidney donors, because cadaver organs are great, and we need more of those, obviously. Definitely check that mark on your ID, get that little heart, but being a living donor is what will change the game on that. And right now, actually during COVID, they're actually slowing down transplants because it's too dangerous to transplant someone who is not like near death.
Wow.
Because of it. So because once you get a transplant, they have to lower your immune system, so your immune system doesn't go, oh, that kidney didn't, we weren't born with that thing. Wait, we have to go attack it. It's clearly an infection. It's not. For anyone who lives with something like lupus or an autoimmune disease, it's very similar to that, where you have to lower the immune system enough that you kind of make it daisy and it just ignores the organ transplant altogether. And so that's something that's unfortunately going on right now with COVID, is we've had to slow down and stop a lot of kidney transplants that would have gone forward otherwise. But I was lucky enough to get a kidney. I was very much at the end of my rope. I actually ended up in a chemical coma right after my kidney transplant, because I nearly died in the OR, and then I nearly died out of the OR because my pulse ox dropped from like a normal like 90 something percent to 40%. And it was bad. They had to intubate me, and we all know what that is nowadays because of COVID. And I woke up 4.5 days later, and I had to learn to walk again because of everything that happened, and also the meds they had to give me. They have to give me paralytics. So I had to learn to walk again, and it was just a whole thing. Currently, I'm in a bout of rejection. I am doing therapies every Friday for rejection right now, and one particularly once a month, which does leave me quite tired. It makes me quite sick. And so I'm going through that. We're very, all my doctors are very positive that the kidney will be perfectly fine. And quite frankly, at this point, we're not worried about losing the kidney. Rejection is much different than failure. Rejection, you can change, you can stop the immune system from going after the kidney and still be left with a good amount of function. Once a organ fails, it's dead. It's a dead person. You're not reanimating it. This isn't Frankenweenie.
Oh, wow. Wow. I mean, I think, you know, you just detailing this kind of transparency over that condition, like a lot of like older folks go through this and probably don't even tell their story about the step-by-step process. So
and then, I mean, I'm our age are actually going through this. There's this, we don't know why, but there's a surge of younger people going through kidney failure, and having high blood pressure, having diabetes, and those can actually make you very susceptible to kidney failure too. Those will totally ravage your kidney if you let it go too far. So kidney disease, especially being on dialysis and being in kidney failure, kills more people than breast cancer and prostate cancer together. So it's it's the disease we don't talk about. We don't think kidneys are important. They are. It's a very deadly disease, and it's something that we can do something about. And being a donor is not difficult. You do a lot of testing. It's a lot of like blood tests and then like getting ultrasounds and other kind of like x-rays and stuff like that. But generally you're in the hospital for 3 days. If you are accepted as a kidney donor, actually most living kidney donors live longer than people that don't, just because they only pick healthy people. You don't have to be a marathon runner. You don't have to be like an MBA.
Oh.
You can just be a normal person with good health and go and see if you can be a kidney donor. And also, the testing also for a few people has actually let them know they have certain chronic illnesses or certain like warning signs. So it's good all around. And my mom was my first kidney donor and she's doing great. She ran a half marathon, literally decided a month beforehand that she was going to run a half marathon. I'm like, Mom, you can't do that. She's a normal runner, but usually like up to like maybe 3 or 4 miles. And then she just did it. And she like got like a really great time. And I had a friend at the time who was a marathon runner. She's like, you shouldn't have been able to do that. Like no one should have been able to do that. Like a month training and you did that. So kidney donation does not really affect your life usually too much. And also if you do, which is very rare, happen to go into kidney failure after being a kidney donor, no matter when, you get put to the top of the list, which means you do not wait 9 to 11 years or 11 to 12 years as is the wait list now. You just kind of like sit there for, get all the testing you need to figure out what you need as far as donorship, and then you just wait for a donor. So it's a process that not a lot of people know about. A lot of people think it's difficult, and you have two kidneys for a reason. So, and when you take one kidney out, the other one literally takes 100% of the job, just like that, boom. So you may not feel great for a couple of weeks, but you just don't feel great for a couple of weeks. And then you're up and going, and you get disability for it, and you never pay a dime. My insurance and my hospital paid everything for my donor. So I have a fabulous hospital. Wow. So I got transplanted to Cedar Sinai and they're just amazing. They are the best hospital I've ever been to. They're so kind.
That's bedside manner matters, especially in today's world.
They even do there. Like that's how like patient centric they are. Like they do therapy, they do all kinds of things. They very much take care of you there and take care of the person. So I'm so happy. I'm so lucky I got them. So, and they take care of transplant patients that are, let's just say, complex. I've had 32 surgeries total. So I go under the complex banner. And so they had no problem taking care of me and being there. And they've saved my life twice. So they're super amazing. Right. And they're a nonprofit hospital. So nonprofits, once again, it's a
yes. life. It is. So I wanted to ask, you know, everyone in 2020 is kind of living out of routine and this is like very new for people, but for you, you constantly, there are things shifting in your life that cause you to live out of routine.
Wait, so what people advice don't spend can you give their to lives you? Living in their home and never leaving? What?
Yeah, it's weird. I think it's so hard for
weird.
So like, I know, like this is kind of living.
This is pretty much while I was on dialysis. A lot of the time I would go out occasionally, but depending on how I felt and also because of my immune system, I could only go out and actually enjoy like what people would consider normal life every once in a while. Most of my life consisted of leaving the house to go to dialysis 3 times a week and coming back and just sleeping because the general recovery time for dialysis is 24 hours. So this is kind of normal for me. And it's funny because I'm in a long distance relationship with my partner of 12 years. And so like webcam, like Skype, all these things are very normal for us. So we were saying like, we're kind of like more equipped to deal with this thing than others. Like, don't get me wrong. Even like when I was a kid and I was sick, I do get cabin fever quite easily. I do need to get out of the house. I can't like just stay indoors, but I can take walks and we've been driving around. Me and my mom and my stepdad have literally just gone on car rides around the valley, gone up to Mount Charleston and things like that, just to like get out of the four walls thing. That's my biggest problem is like the same four walls all the time. But I'm a crafter. I love card making. I'm someone who has to have a creative outlet or else I drive people around me crazy, specifically my fiance. I always have to have a project, as he says. And luckily, you know, now that it's not summer anymore, I have class and I'm really enjoying my classes and I work and that really like helps keep me in a good, healthy headspace. I have a therapist which helps with that too. I was supposed to go over to England for a second time in June to see my fiance because we fly back and forth to see each other.
at least once or twice a year. And so that was a bit of a downer. But now I'm learning French, so the next time I go over, we can go to Paris and I can, like, you know, use my newfound skill, however good it is. Right. It may just be me saying, like, my name a little bit, but yeah, so.
So tying this all together, how do you think having experienced New Leadership Nevada has propelled you into this, the next 8 years of your life and beyond, Jenny?
I think it prepared me in the fact of giving me the headspace of rejecting, rejecting the fact that I'm not good enough or I can't do something, or just because I don't know something that I can't do it. I think I was taught there that, you know, there's always going to be a learning gap, and you may not have gone to school. That was the biggest thing I took from it, was just because you didn't get a degree in this doesn't mean you can't do that. Take your skills and use them wherever you go. Because skills aren't just a one sector thing. You use them everywhere. And I learned how able I am to be a leader, because you meet people from everywhere that do everything, and you realize being a leader isn't being, like, you know, the captain of the team. It's being the person that helps other people move forward and go forward and learn, and just, it's a group mentality. It's not just me doing great and, like, and being looking great and getting, like, awards and, like, titles. It's about that forward motion of everyone and, you know, not leaving anyone behind, and taking that person aside and going, what do you need help with? What do I need to, like, what do I need to facilitate for you? And that's really what leadership is. And everyone is capable of that. Every human being is capable of that. From the youngest person to the oldest person, no matter where you come from, no matter your background, it's just that point of, like, stepping outside your comfort zone a little bit, which is my favorite place to be. I love being out of my own, and just saying, today I'm gonna take that extra step, and I'm gonna try and, like, help someone forward, and I'm gonna help myself forward in the process.
Thank you, Jenny. Thank you for being here and sharing the space and sharing your truths.
Oh, thank you. Anytime.
You know, with your advocacy, yeah, and yourself. It is the best part of my job, is even if I wasn't there when you went through the program, I get to see people be like you, in a sense of finding themselves, finding their niche, finding their advocacy route. And so thank you so much.
Well, Jen. Thank you. I love talking, as always.